The first argument is from C.S. Lewis, who I think is overrated, like G.K. Chesterton, who's overrated too. And while I'm making people upset, Taylor Swift's new album is terrible, pineapple belongs on pizza, and the millennial and Gen Z impulse to carry a water bottle everywhere is less about hydration than unrequited childhood affection for one's mother. All right, well, now that we've lost all the listeners, I think it's time to begin. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Yes, I think C.S. Lewis's argument from Desire fails, and I don't care who knows it. I might be attacking a lot of your favorite arguments here, but here's the thing. We need to be as honest as possible about what arguments for theism succeed and which ones plain old don't. Or at least, they don't really provide as much evidence as we think they might provide at first glance. So I'm going to be going through about 8 of them. And for each one, I'm going to be suggesting a kind of similar argument that works instead. So, let's kick it off with good old C.S. Lewis, who writes, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire with no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If that is so, I must take care, on one hand, never to despise or be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and, on the other, never to mistake them for something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find until after death. I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life to press on to that other country and to help others do the same." Now, yes, Lewis, this is true. You do have these desires. They're oriented towards heaven. They're oriented towards God. They're oriented to all these things. You are made for not just this earthly life, but a resurrected life. Yes, yes, yes. But this just isn't a good argument for the existence of that other life, nor is it a good argument for God. Here's the way that Peter Kraft organizes what he just said into a couple premises. The major premise is every natural or innate desire in us points to a corresponding real object that can satisfy the desire. Minor premise, there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. Conclusion, there exists outside of time, earth, and creatures, something that can satisfy this desire. Now, here are a couple reasons that I don't like this argument. Numero uno, it is absolutely ripe for a reductio ad absurdum. And here are a few. One, most kids, after watching Star Wars, have a desire to use the Force. Now, one might object that this is not a natural desire because they were first told a story that they then play out and form desires around. True. And would that not be the counterargument from an atheist about religion or the supernatural? Has not every child, almost without exception throughout history, been told such a religious or supernatural story? Would they not try to act this out also? Would they not then long for heaven, nirvana, God, paradise, inner peace, radical dissolution of self, or any other such aspect of the religious story that they were told, just like they longed to use the Force and open up doors with their mind? Of course they would. But that, I don't think, is the best reductio. The one that pops up in the literature is, and this I think is incredibly forceful and much more natural and absolutely ubiquitous, the desire to change the past. Now, I think that this is impossible, though we may have to have another time episode where we get into a much more nuanced view on the possibility and impossibility of changing the past and what the past is and what time is. But suffice to say, I think in any reasonable rendition of what time itself is, the idea that one in the present can change the past is impossible. And yet, we all have a natural desire to be able to go back and undo mistakes or go back and seize opportunities that we let slip by. I think this is as natural of an instinct as anything. And no, it's not fulfilled. Now, maybe you might say that the real desire is actually to have acted differently or to have had events transpire differently. But if this type of reinterpretation is on the table, I think it can cut both ways. What if this imagined desire for the infinite is just a desire for a lot, or a desire to not have the things which satisfy our desire stop? Not necessarily we need an actual infinite. Or maybe you simply misunderstand these desires and their natural ends. Maybe there is a way to get satisfied in some of these desires, or maybe they're not as ubiquitous as people are saying. If we're going to reinterpret my reductio here about time, I think that we need the same amount of latitude reinterpreting what C.S. Lewis puts forth in his argument, at which point I think there's lots of things which can answer this this supposed problem. Which leads us to issue two. I think premise one is highly contestable. And to remind you, that is every natural or innate desire in us points us to a corresponding real object that can satisfy this desire. Desires are for goods, sure, but the possession of some goods need to be bounded, and the possession of other goods may not need to be bounded. Therefore, our desires could come in two forms, bounded and unbounded desires. So there's a maximum amount of food that evolutionary programming would orient you towards. Likewise with sleep or sex or water and such like. But what about the feeling of joy? Well, I would say that's probably just an unbounded desire. Whereas with food, evolutionary programming wants you to not starve and not die of the diabetes. So it's going to point you kind of in the middle, shoving you one way or the other. But the feeling of joy, for instance, well, that feeling is often because you are living a balanced, thriving, and safe life. So why on earth would evolution ever care to evolve for you a limit to the feeling that marks your thriving in a balanced and verdant life? Your possession of a balanced and full life, well, that doesn't necessarily need to be limited. Now, does that mean that we will have an unlimited type? No, it just means that in our evolutionary environment, there was never a loss to the continuing of pursuing this desire. Thus, it was selected for in a way that, say, always eating more can certainly be problematic. So you get a feeling of being full. Therefore, the need for joy or existential fulfillment or awe or wonder could all simply represent the fact that there was no need to ever evolve a stop or limit to the pursuit of these ends, since there is always or almost always a marginal benefit from their pursuit, unlike those other desires. Simple as that. And I have another problem with this argument. I really don't know what the use of its conclusion is, or if that even works. Remember, the conclusion is there exists something outside of time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. That's what he concludes at. Well, not found in time? I don't see how this gets us to something outside of time. That seems like a little bit of a leap. If we just say, hey, there's something that's not in time, then we might just say it doesn't exist. You would have to prove that it's outside of time and exists in some type of incredible eternity, which is only God has. And I don't see any positive argument for that, at least here. So if you just say, hey, it's not in time and it's no creature, then absent some positive reasons for this being the God of classical theism, it sounds like your argument concludes in, it's not there because it's not in space or time or in any type of creature. I don't think it concludes in God as such. Also, I mean, there's no experience that we have found, or at least he says there's no experience we have found to fulfill these desires. But I think we could actually imagine times where that could be. The experience machine that I forget what philosopher came up with. What if we could make a machine that hooks into your brain and creates the maximally awesome experience for you? It uses some machine learning and AI to figure out how to absolutely optimize your joy and happiness at any given moment. Yeah, it brings in just the right amount of struggle and suffering and everything. And it's basically an extension of the algorithms that we have that make, I don't know, Twitter or TikTok or anything else so enjoyable. It's constantly learning how to make you engaged. Well, what if we had such an advanced machine? It would seem to maximally meet any type of desire we could have. C.S. Lewis would be instead arguing for the existence of the experience machine, not a god necessarily. I don't see why his argument couldn't conclude at the AI existence machine. That's something which doesn't exist on Earth now, has not satisfied any of our desires now, but isn't in principle impossible to exist. Therefore, why isn't this the conclusion? And why would it have to be God, and the God of Christianity, the God of classical theism? Finally, we could even conclude at other things which aren't AI machines. What about an angel or a demon who can interface with our immaterial soul and somehow satisfy our desires? I don't think he's proven that these desires are in fact infinite, because we aren't infinite beings after all. So why couldn't an angel or demon meet this test? Couldn't they do that? Possibly. I don't know. I don't see anything in his arguments that would preclude an angel or a demon from taking on this role, just like the experience machine would. Why would it have to be God? I just don't see it. And even if all of this works, I think it radically underdetermines what this God is, or the supernatural, giving us barely a glimpse of what it seeks to prove. I think a Buddhist could run this argument about enlightenment. A Native American could run this same argument, concluding at the Great Spirit. A Jordan Peterson could conclude at an overly abstract Jungian conception of a something and rather. But I really don't see it reaching God. Here's what I suggest instead. Why not pick some version of Aquinas' fifth way? Trace back the reason for the orientation of a thing given its former nature, see that an infinite series of dependent natures is impossible, and never determines a given end. Arrive at a nature that must exist, has its end in and of itself, not through another, and can cause the direction of other things by imbuing them with determinate natures, or such like. Thus, we can reason from our orientation to the religious that the power that directed us there to this end, making us religious creatures, intends for religion. And if this were true, then we could say that since religion is oriented towards God, and the thing orienting us is actually orienting us back to himself. That seems like a much better argument, working off the fifth way instead of working off these very vague desires, which I don't see as being infinite, ones which I don't think are highly descriptive of what God is, ones which I don't think end with classical theism, ones which I think could be explained perfectly well by an evolutionary process. I think we should ditch his argument and go for something else. But we have other arguments to cover. What about the moral argument, you may ask? Now, I've said in many other podcasts that I think that forms of the moral argument do in fact score some points for theism. However, I just don't think they're on the level as other arguments, ones like Aquinas' first way, or third way, or heck, second way, or fourth way, of course. Here's Craig's formulation, William Lane Craig's formulation of the moral argument. 1. If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. 2. Objective moral values do exist. 3. Therefore, God exists. And don't get me wrong, from a Bayesian or prior probability kind of perspective, the probability of objective, or let's back it up from objective, let's just say, very modest claim, that there seems to be compelling, and at least seemingly universally binding moral facts that can come to oppose our other desires, and that we seem to see easily through intuition, that shape society in a better way. Is this more likely under naturalism, or is it more likely under theism? Well, I would say, given the theistic hypothesis that God, who is good, created a good universe and created us with religion in mind, with morality in mind, well, what's the object, but what's the probability that we would have this clear vision of moral facts? Well, under theism, it would be like 100%. It's almost completely certain that a God of classical theism would bring this about at some point. Well, what's the odds under naturalism that this would be the case, that there would be creatures with these moral seemings, which are at least appear to be universally binding, incredibly compelling, and can oppose natural desires, even to the point of opposing our natural desire to persist living? People sacrifice themselves for moral ideals. I don't think that's terribly predicted under naturalism. Do I think it's impossible? No, but I don't think it's terribly probable. There's absolutely no issue under naturalism with the entire universe just being a bunch of asteroids made of iron continually just floating about in space. No issue there. The idea that we have this state of affairs is not predicted under naturalism. Okay, so that's why I think it does have some force and it does score some points for a theism. But let's get on to some of the criticisms. The obvious move is to say that there seem to be moral facts, but these are not real moral facts. Instead, they're just deeply embedded instinctual patterns of thought that were produced through evolution. And of course, one might object that this deeply embedded moral urge might demand something like self-sacrifice to save a friend. Yet this does not confer an evolutionary benefit to the one's offsprings. Therefore, it could not have been selected for. But those types of common critiques, I think, are instead evidence of a very shallow understanding of evolution. As Richard Dawkins points out, people need not be selfish. They could be entirely altruistic, but the genes are being selfish. So what we don't have is an actual competition of individual creatures. We have a competition of genes, which are replicating via the creatures that they are expressed in. So the gene is replicating. That is the goal, not necessarily the individual. So if you save a bunch of your cousins, well, the genes have succeeded. Why? Because there's more of your genes in your, say, five cousins on average than there are in you. So, wonderful. Actually, way more. Three cousins. I don't know. Some amount of cousins. My cousins might know. The next issue is that there's actually layers of competition at work. It's too simplistic to think that you're just in competition with, say, another person in your tribe. Because in a tribe, you have to cooperate well enough to be in competition with the neighboring tribe. And if your tribe can't work together, then your tribe as a whole could be selected against. And further, all of the tribes in an area of, say, humans could be competing against other species for valuable resources, like lions or bears or sharks or sharknadoes or something. So if your species can't work together well enough to stop so much infighting, then the lions might win. And it doesn't even stop there, because there's further layers of competition. Because if your ecosystem, inclusive of the lions and the zebras and you and the grassland, etc., if that can't be competitive against rival ecosystems, well, then everybody fails. So we could have a forest ecosystem neighboring a grassland. And maybe it's a highly successful grassland, and it takes over the forest. That happens sometimes. Or maybe the predators in that grassland are not numerous enough, which means the grazing patterns of the buffalo or woolly mammoths aren't conducive to have successful grassland, because when they're diffuse, the grass doesn't thrive as much as when they clump together in the presence of predators. So if we don't have that type of predation, we don't have the right grazing. If we don't have the right grazing, then we don't have the right growth of the grassland. If we don't have the right growth of the grassland, then the neighboring forests could encroach. And if they encroach, the entire ecosystem gets wiped out. So even if the, I don't know, let's keep going. All of these ecosystems together, if they're just warring against each other in a way that is not advantageous for the whole, well, then they could lose in competition to just entropy in general. If they're tearing each other apart, we might end up with nothing. It's like mutually assured destruction. So it's far too simplistic to think that evolution would always select for people being a bunch of meanies. It certainly wouldn't. Further, my issue with this type of theistic critique of what evolution would yield is actually basically an inversion of Kant's moral argument. Let me explain. Immanuel Kant, after rejecting Aquinas' arguments for gods and others, proposes a moral argument that he refers to as a postulate of practical reason. Here's a brief summary pulled from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Kant held that a rational, moral being must necessarily will the highest good, which consists of a world in which people are both morally good and happy, and in which moral virtue is the condition for happiness. The latter condition implies that this end must be sought solely by moral action. However, Kant held that a person cannot rationally will such an end without believing that moral actions can successfully achieve such an end. And this requires a belief that the causal structure of nature is conducive to the achievement of this end by moral means. This is equivalent to belief in God, a moral being who is ultimately responsible for the character of the natural world. So to claim that the structure of the world that God did create that does include evolution does not conduce to the morality of the creatures or provide a framework for the achievement of happiness through the pursuit of moral precepts seems antithetical to Kant's conception of God and mine. I straight up reject the theistic critique of the evolutionary explanation for morality on the grounds that God would not structure reality in such a way that being moral causes his system to fail or else function poorly. I think that the way we all, as creatures, thrive the most is by any moral creature acting morally. I think that's how all of nature benefits the most, when we are truly perfect moral agents. Hashtag the Garden of Eden. Which is my full argument from Scripture. That is exactly the beginning, that we as moral agents were properly ordered to one another and God, and this is the thriving of all nature and natural things. So to sum this up, to say that the natural world would produce immoral beings because not acting morally causes the structure as a whole to thrive is to claim that God created a bad world. One where the structure of reality penalizes morality, and where acting evilly helps the maximum amount of beings to flourish, and that just seems like nonsense. One could object that Satan is the fallen governor of the natural world, thus maybe this is, you know, this is what's going on. And sure, that totally could be the case. However, Satan did not create any of the natures of any of the beings that we're talking about. He can throw a stick in the spokes of the wheel, but he does not create the bicycle. So I don't see how this Satan objection really helps here, because God is responsible for the structure of reality and the nature of the creatures in reality. Whether or not they thrive as creatures, being moral or not, I think would be up to God. Now, Satan can come in and screw stuff up, but the basic structure of this, I think, means that a good God would not penalize moral action in his good universe. And it seems when theists say evolution could never create moral beings, they're making a claim about the reality that God created, saying the reality God created would preferentially select for evil and not good, and I think that's false. All right, so I think the path here, in light of all this, is to agree with Kant, not on many things, but on this thing, that the structure of reality seems to give points to theism. because it seems designed for moral agents to thrive when being moral. I think that's points theism. However, this tosses out that argument against the natural explanation, i.e. evolution. This, I think we ought to say, that natural virtues could and would arise from an evolutionary process, and we ought to embrace these fields of study and not just see them as rivaling the theistic picture. Natural virtues, not theological virtues, but natural virtues could certainly arise for some creatures like us through a natural process since God made that process. And I think that certainly helps our case. It doesn't hurt it. And again, the argument that I think is valid amongst moral arguments is the more Bayesian one. Which paradigm better predicts a system that produces moral agents? Well, the naturalistic paradigm would be perfectly comfortable with a universe of those iron asteroids floating in space forever, with no life, with no intelligent life, with no time or place ever for a moral landscape to unfold, and with no conscious, willful, rational beings ever existing. Nothing in the naturalistic paradigm precludes something like that. In fact, if we were just roll the dice on the start of the universe, I would imagine the vast majority of universes could pop out much like this. But the theistic picture instead, starting from the idea that we have the God of classical theism who is good, and we know that good is diffusive of itself, hashtag Boethius, we could conclude that a creator God who lights up his creation with abundant goods, including goods like moral virtues, ought to have a community in which these moral virtues and moral goods are shared, even shared via the virtue of religion with their creator. That's highly predicted, this moral landscape, moral creatures, and a whole system which is designed for moral actors acting morally to succeed and be happy. That's all predicted under theism, very strongly not predicted under naturalism. That's the type of argument I like, not the one that says evolution could never do it, therefore God must have somehow made us moral. No, that's making a claim about God's universe, which I don't think is consistent with the action that God actually took, Scripture says he took, or that would make sense given his character. So what should we use instead of this moral argument? Well, we talked briefly about goodness. Why not just run a fourth way argument, dear listeners? I have run that one many, many, many times in places. The fourth way allows us to look at the gradation of goodness and to ultimately conclude at God, see one of the many episodes. So that's what I would pick instead of the moral argument. We can still talk about the goodness in the world, but I think we can do it in a more philosophically rigorous way, which doesn't just give a little bit of evidence or points towards theism, but actually locks it up. The next argument I don't really like is the Kalam argument. Now, this is kind of an honorable mention, an honorable, dishonorable mention. I almost didn't include this one. And here's why. I think it works just fine, given an A theory of time, and without people running away, flailing their arms, screaming, multiverse, as we yell back, but where the heck did the multiverse generator come from, and where the heck is your evidence for a bazillion invisible universes? My issue is not that it doesn't work. I think it does. My issue is actually the abstraction of divine attributes. For example, Aquinas repeatedly concludes with his arguments at a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all of this by logical necessity. But the biggest proponent of the Kalam cosmological argument, William Lane Craig, ends with, and I quote, a God who is, well, it says, it must be unimaginably powerful. So he concludes at an unimaginably powerful God, and I don't think that's good enough. I want to conclude where Aquinas concluded, at a God who is maximum power himself, an all-powerful God. Not just a really powerful God. So later he sees that with this argument alone, it could actually bring him to some other bullets that he has to bite. And this man has no problem biting bullets. One of which is, it seems, given his conception of God extracted from the Kalam, that this type of God would have to enter into time upon the creation of the universe, which I think is really, 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 really wrong. God is in principle outside of time, and we can get that again from many of Aquinas's arguments, but we actually go in the wrong way on this if we just stick with the Kalam. Next, Craig is leaning on Al-Ghazi's argument that the cause is freely willing, because if the cause created necessarily, then the effect, the universe, would be existing necessarily. Yet, if that was the case, then it would always exist. And since the universe, the effect, does not always exist, this means that it must have been a free will decision to create the universe, not a necessitated, determinist will, because otherwise it would always be. So he thinks that we can prove that this cause is actually free because it was not a determined cause. And I mean, as far as that goes, that's interesting, right? I think he's, again, that's not wrong that we can prove that whatever caused the universe was not determined to cause the universe. Sure. But that doesn't actually get us to a free-willing being. Because free will is not just that which is not determined. That's not a correct definition of free will. I can give you examples of non-willful, indeterminate causes. For instance, a decaying atom can spit out an alpha particle now or now. No big deal. Now, there's a reason for it. It's because it's this type of atom and not that type of atom. And it will create a distribution of decay because it clumps towards an average time of decay. But the actual point of decay, well, it's indeterminate. It could be now. It could be later. Let me give you another one. There's the case I pointed out a while ago where if you have a perfect point and you put a perfect sphere on top, there are two 100% valid mathematical solutions for what happens next. One, that it moves off of the infinitely small point. And two, that it stays there forever. And it is entirely valid to model it leaving that point in any direction. Could go left, could go right, doesn't matter. Now, is there a reason for it staying still? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fact that it is a sphere and it's on a point and it is like this and not that. And that would be the same explanation for if it rolled right or left. So it's not a brute fact, but it's not determined to be one thing or another. It's an indeterminate cause of a given event. So there you go. There's a variety of examples of indeterminate causes which do not have will whatsoever. So again, as far as it goes, the Kalam is fine. There's no problem with it. The issue is it doesn't prove as much as people think it proves. It doesn't prove a free-willing being. It would simply prove that there is not a determinate cause for the universe. Does this give some points towards theism? Yeah, I think it does. The fact that the universe came into being, that's highly predicted under theism. That's even highly predicted by our sacred texts that say, in the beginning. Some mad points for theism. Does that show that the universe is contingent? Oh, certainly it does. And a contingency argument can certainly arrive at God. And if we find that the universe came into being, definitely contingent. Ergo, we can arrive at God. But with the Kalam argument itself, without those forays into other better arguments, I don't see it giving us the God of classical theism. So Ghazi's cosmological argument gives us powerful grounds for believing in the existence of a beginningless, causeless, timeless, spaceless, changeless, immaterial, enormously powerful, personal creator of the universe. That is the conclusion that William Lane Craig derives. However, what he just said, something which is all this stuff, I think could be an angel, could be a demon, could be a crazy cool immaterial alien, or the god of any variety of religions. Further, I do take issues with other claims, like beginningless. I would take the more modest claim that the cause could not be in our timeline. I don't see how the cause would be exempted from any timeline. So that's just an example. And I have talked about how I've argued with acolytes of William Lane Craig, and they admitted that the God, which is concluded at by the Kalam, would meet the description of what in Catholic theology could be described as an angel. So it doesn't conclude at something as high as God, but could actually, all this stuff could be met by, say, an angel. And I think that's an enormous problem. Or the demon, or the crazy cool alien. And I guess I could pick apart some of these other ones, so it doesn't have to be timeless, but outside of our timeline, doesn't have to be uncaused, but it could be caused in a different place. So that's the multiverse objection. Changeless, I don't think that we could arrive at that one. We could say there's a chain of causality which exits our universe. Immaterial, I think it depends on how you describe materiality. Enormously powerful, that one's a red flag right there because it doesn't target omnipowerful properties, so it shows it's not actually targeting our creator. It can't specify something that good. And saying it's a personal creator of the universe, well, that relies on that free will argument that we already talked about. So what should we use instead? Well, my favorite Islamic philosopher, by far, it's not close, is a guy named Avicenna. And he made an argument that actually worked. And it does secure the divine attributes. And a version of his argument gets modified and used by Maimonides, by Aquinas, by John Duns Scotus, and plenty of others. And here's another big perk. We see that Craig is building off the Kalam argument from Al-Ghazi's version. And guess who Al-Ghazi really didn't like? You got it. Our guy, Avicenna. Let me tell you about this guy, Avicenna. He wrote an autobiography. And in it, this is my favorite story, he says, sorry about the accent. I'll be using an Indian accent because I don't actually have a Middle Eastern accent. When I was a child, when I was only 12 years old, I would teach all of my teachers. All of the teachers would come and say, Avicenna, tell us about philosophy. We have taught you everything. You are so far ahead of us and so advanced. We have to just listen to what you are saying. And not only was I so smart, and even when I was just a baby, but also whenever I would go to the mosque to pray, all of the women of the town would just be on the sides of the street saying, Avicenna, you are so incredibly smart and you are also incredibly handsome. And I would say, woman, do not look at me. I am only looking at God. I am walking to pray and you distract me, but I am also so holy that I will not have any thoughts which are impure. That is almost word for word from his autobiography. That's right. He claims, maybe it's true, he taught all of his teachers by the age of 12. And whenever he would go to pray, all of the women would line up on the sides of the roads just to watch him walk to the mosque. But holy and reverent as he was, he would go there without even a thought of lust because he had his mind set on God. What a guy you are, Avicenna. May I add humble? But he did have a lot to be proud of. And we'll be going into his argument for God in depth. Now, I will warn you, I am not an expert in his thought in Islamic philosophy or actually really in anything. But here we go anyways. I'll try to give you the thrust of his proof for God. But a little bit of setup. He starts by showing that existence exists and that something exists. So those are two different claims. So we have existence proper certainly exists. That's pretty irrefutable. And that something exists. And he kind of relies on what could be like a Descartes-type argument, that you can't actually deny that. It can never be negated because who would be doing the negating? So Descartes, not near as revolutionary as people think. Not only did Avicenna already, just in passing, make his point, but Augustine did and many others did because it's pretty obvious. All right, so that's the first thing he says, is something exists and existence exists. So there's existence and there are individual instances of existence. And he presents a fundamental distinction between possibility and necessity. That's the next move he makes. And let's say Descartes is in his Avicenna's philosophy class, and he doubts that he is really in class and thinks that he could instead be dreaming. He has affirmed here Avicenna's distinction between possibility and necessity, because it is possible that he is in class. class, and it is possible that he is dreaming. Further, if he is either in class or not in class, which would include all possibilities, then the fact of his being in class or not is necessary in light of the existence of him in class, right? So here we have, coming out of the existence of, say, the thing that we know must exist, like the thinking Descartes, we can derive the possibility and the necessity, concepts themselves. Thus, the basic things that Avicenna has shown us are existence and the two big divisions, possibility and necessity. And of course, he also points to a third category that doesn't relate to existence, but is instead its logical contrary, which is impossibility. So that's what he has in his ontology so far. He's really building from some pretty self-evident kind of bricks here. And then he tries to show us that he has reached bedrock. And his test is to show that there's a type of self-evidence or a type of, non-vicious circularity. That's his test of basicness, and shows that existence is basic because it must imply itself to be itself. And the notions of necessity, possibility, and impossibility taken together are circular, since to define possible requires the notion of necessary and impossible. So possible is not necessary, nor is it impossible. And then when we go to describe, necessary, well, then we have to say this is something that must be this way and not that way. And then we're implying a possibility, which is actual, etc. So he sees these three things, and he's following Aristotle. The necessary, the possible, and the impossible, their definitions actually, if you look carefully, seem to imply one another. Now, there's another instance where it seems, apparently, that he takes the contrary view, but apparently, if you're very smart and you read even more, you find out, no, that is not the case. These are indeed all relying on one another, and he takes this as a test of them truly being basic and linked directly to existence, as we kind of sketched out earlier. Okay, so my boy Avicenna, I literally just found this out. I have been working on an argument for how time, the nature of time, can actually be reduced to act in potency, or if you will, a type of actual existence and potential existence. And I have been intending to submit this as a journal article. However, I found in looking into our guy Avicenna that he lays out pretty much exactly the argument that I've been working on, so it's certainly been thought of already. And he even launches it based on reflection on the exact same passage of Aristotle that I was working on. So good job, Avicenna. I guess I don't have to write that after all. We'll talk about that. Let's keep on going. Let's give you a basic rundown here. So Avicenna works off of the possibility and necessity instead of act and potency. His thought seems to be targeting the same basic phenomena. So in short, the idea for time is that time is the relation between act and potency. For instance, you have a piece of wood that you need to heat up. That is a potential to be hot, but it's actually cold. And then if you use a blowtorch to heat it up, time is reduced versus if you used a small match to heat it up. So the power of the actualizer means that the amount of time that it takes will increase or decrease. Likewise, with the type of possible state that it will become, so if we have a larger potency to be actualized, let's say the potential for a cathedral to be here and not there, well, that would take a long time if we hold constant the power of the actualizer, let's say one medieval peasant. So in order to reduce the time for this to come into being, we would instead need to increase the power of our actualizer or decrease the scale of the potency to be actualized. So he makes this argument, and he reduces time to something like act and potency, though he's focusing more on necessity and and potential, and rooting both of these in the way that they describe existence, which is very close to act and potency, because Aquinas talks about act as inclusive of existence. And of course, this type of view of time solves a bazillion things, and I've talked about it elsewhere, and I already know that this is a digression inside of this digression. So all that to say, when he runs the argument that we're about to dig into, ending in a necessary being, his definition of time stands there to block any wiggling out of the conclusion by imagining an infinite regress, a block of time, any type of B theory, circular temporal causation. All of that stuff is off the table because he began by reducing time, in a way, out of his ontology. Now, he actually views it as a proof for the existence of time, but he shows that time is derivative of things which are actually linked to considering existence. So how does this argument go? Well, I'll be reading from an excellent article by John McGillis called The Ultimate Why Question Explained. So, fair warning, this is the home of the longest primary source quotes, and I guess the secondary source, so we're going to go for that title too. So strap in. I think that I gave you enough setup with the time stuff, with the possibility, the necessity, the impossibility, and the nature of existence, and the Descartes stuff. You should be ready. Let's take a brief break right here for me to sip the coffee, and then we're going to dive right in. Thus, Avicenna describes the, quote, necessary in itself as that mode of being that is in itself wholly derivative, and as such, wholly determinate, and as such is in need of no cause to explain its existing at all. In fact, should the necessary in itself exist, there would be no conditions whatsoever under which it could fail to exist. Conversely, Avicenna describes the possible in itself as that mode of being that is indeterminate between existence and non-existence, in which case either the presence of a cause selectively determines that it exists, or the absence of a cause selectively determines that it does not exist. Again, these claims are not intended to be definitions of the modal terms they describe, but rather descriptions of them. As such, they provide one simply with criteria for identifying and so determining what would count as falling under one or the other of existence's divisions. For the sake of completeness, I shall add that Avicenna made one further division of existence, which, as it were, is a hybrid of the necessary in itself and the possible in itself. This further division is that which is possible in itself, but necessary through another. Namely, it exists necessarily as a result of a cause. In effect, this last division, namely, the possible in itself, but necessary through another, corresponds with any created thing's actual or determinate existence. With this final division, Avicenna's analysis of existence is complete. Avicenna's criteria for identifying the necessary and the possible in itself, as well as the possible in itself, but necessary through another, can be found in the Metaphysics book, blah, 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 etc. All right. Bearing in mind the primacy of the necessary and the possible in Avicenna's thought, as well as their descriptions, I want to turn to Avicenna's argument for a necessary existent or God as he presents it is it as in his smaller encyclopedic work, the Nevat, or in Latin, the Metaphysics Compendium. Okay, here, as in the other book, Avicenna takes it as beyond doubt that something exists and that the necessary and the possible are the primary divisions of existence, using this division of existence as his starting point. Avicenna argues that there must be a necessary existent as follows, if, on the one hand, the existence that immediately presents itself to us is necessary. So recall, the Descartes-type move of having existence present itself to oneself. So if this is necessary, whatever presents itself, then there is a necessary existence. On the other hand, if the existence of which we are immediately aware is only possible existence, then given the description of the possible, it must have a cause. At this point, rather than denying the impossibility of an infinite causal chain, as virtually all earlier physical arguments for the existence of God had done, Avicenna asks his reader to consider the totality of all the possible things that exist at some given moment, regardless of whether that totality is finite or infinite. He next observes that the existence of this totality itself must be either necessary in itself or possible in itself, given again that these are the two primary divisions of existence and that the totality itself exists. So on the other hand, the totality cannot be something necessary in itself, argues Avicenna, for the existence of a totality subsists only through the existence of its members, in which case that which is purportedly necessary in itself would be necessary through another, namely its members. But this is a contradiction. Moreover, it is impossible that there should be any conditions under which the necessary in itself should fail to exist. For this is one of the very criteria by which one identifies necessary existence. If, however, all the members of the totality exist only possibly in themselves, and things that exist possibly in themselves can fail to exist, then, if each of the members of the totality failed to exist, the totality itself would fail to exist. In other words, there is at least one condition under which the totality of all possible things could fail to exist, namely, if all of its members failed to exist. Again, however, there is no condition under which the necessary in itself could fail to exist, should it exist. Now, guys, this is an awesome one for people who say, well, sure, it's the composition fallacy. You know, you could have everything contingent in the universe, but the universe as a whole could be necessary. Well, Avicenna just told us exactly why that's bull. Because there is one condition for everything, the universe as a whole, to fail to exist. And that is if all of its members failed to exist, which is absolutely possible if they are only possibly existing beings. And if they're necessarily existing, well, he'll get to that part. Consequently, the totality of things possible in themselves cannot exist necessarily in itself. On the other hand, Avicenna continues, if the totality is something existing possibly in itself, then in order for the totality to exist, it needs something that provides its existence, that is, causes it to exist, which will be either external or internal to the totality. If it is something existing internal to the totality, it itself would be one of the members of the totality, and as such, that member cannot exist necessarily, since the assumption is that the totality includes only things possible in themselves. Thus, if the cause of the totality's existence were internal and necessary, in itself, there would be a contradiction. Furthermore, the cause of the totality's existence cannot be something internal and possible in itself, for since anything internal is part of the totality itself, it would be the cause of its own existence. In that case, one and the same thing would be both a cause and an effect in the very same respect, which Avicenna himself takes to be absurd. Still, it would seem that Avicenna was aware that the denial of self-causation with respect to existence is too physically robust a claim for his metaphysical argument. Thus, per impossible, he granted, for the sake of argument, that something could cause its own existence. However, in that case, one must concede that this member is sufficient to necessitate its own existence, in which case it exists necessarily through itself. Again, however, the assumption is that the totality includes only things possible in themselves, and so again, there would be a contradiction, namely, something is both necessary in itself and possible in itself. Thus, only one option is left, that the totality is possible in itself, and the cause of its existence is something external to the totality. Again, this external thing cannot be something possible in itself, for everything existing possibly in itself is included within the totality. Consequently, this external cause of the existence of all things possible in themselves must fall within existence other division, namely the necessary in itself. Therefore, concludes Avicenna, this external cause is something that exists necessarily in itself, and so there must be a necessary existence. There you go. And I'll see if I can track down at some point some translation of his, but I think a very good summary that's given. Now, if you got strong third way of Aquinas vibes, well, yeah. And if you ever wondered what Aquinas meant by possible beings can fail to exist, well, I think Avicenna actually is showing what he meant there. What the beings failing to exist mean is that we can't take the sum total of all possibly existing things to be necessary, because necessary means there is no condition for it to not exist. If there is a condition for it to not exist, it is a possible being. A possible being has to have a cause in order to be about, because otherwise, if it didn't need a cause to be about, it would be a necessary being. So he's saying that there is one thing that the whole would need, and that would be to never have all of its parts go out of being. So there is something which is a condition for the whole being round. Ergo, the universe as a whole cannot be necessary. And there we go. So we have nothing in the universe, because then it would be both potential and necessary. It can't be it as a whole. Therefore, it has to be something outside of it causing all these potential contingent beings. Also sounds a lot like Joss Rasmussen's Blob of Everything. Kind of sounds a bit like the Dante at times, and it certainly gives some Barry Miller vibes, this whole idea that any given entity seems to include this type of circularity and thus would be impossible without a necessary existent. That's something that good old Miller points out as well. So that's the argument that I think you should be using instead. Avicenna is so much better than Al-Ghazi. It's not even funny. So ditch the kalam, and if you want a kalam-type argument, kalam just means philosophy, just means Islamic philosophy is what the Arabic word for philosophy, then this is also a kalam argument, because it comes from an Islamic thinker, but one who thinks a little bit harder. And if you read a little bit more of his work, you see that out of what he arrived at the end of his argument, out of this, we can actually pull a variety, all of the divine attributes out. And he does that at length and with rigor. So that's what I suggest instead. Which leads us to the ontological argument. I think that's an argument that many of us love to hate. I really don't understand why this argument gets so much press, because I'm absolutely sure that you have heard of it. It's like if in conversations about cars, everybody kept bringing up the Chrysler 200. Like, why? It's unremarkable, probably broken, unpopular, can't be relied upon to get you anywhere of note. That is the ontological argument. Granted, it's not the worst argument, and neither was the Chrysler 200 the worst car. I'm sure it has its charms. But this only adds to the puzzle. It's not good enough to use and not bad enough to mock. I mean, the Chrysler 200, it took a 2-minute Super Bowl ad with Eminem, my rap rival, somehow trying to pump this thing in 2011. And still, nobody knew it existed. But strangely, the ontological argument needs no marketing. I suspect that it is exactly this middling status as an argument that makes it so popular. Atheist philosophy professors can trot it out as if it was theists' main argument, and it's tough enough to debunk that it will stroke their tender egos, and easy enough to debunk that a sophomore texting in class can still follow along as it is debunked. Now, there are a lot of formulations of this. I think probably the best would be the second version of Ansem's argument, or maybe Plantinga's argument, because that one's written in a super strong logical structure. It's like S5 logic or something crazy. But I think they all make fundamentally the same group of errors. So let's get into a little bit of that. They're basically trying to go from the possibility of a greatest possible being that can be conceived to the fact that this being does truly exist. Now, already, our dude, Avicenna, would be raising a very thick yet impeccably groomed eyebrow at this. God is not possible, he might say. Why the heck are you starting from your God being a possibly greatest being? Why are you going from a possibility premise? That's exactly what he's not. He's an actually existing one. You're messing up already. So to define him as possible is to actually misdefine him as badly as if you were defining him as impossible. So why not just be like Avicenna? Argue for the necessary existent, extract the divine attributes, and get all the ladies. And over in the corner without any girls is grumpy old Kant with his objection that existence is not a real predicate. In other words, he thinks that we could make statements of the whatness of a thing for non-existent things all day long. I'm thinking of a unicorn, which is very big and very beautiful. It has the most majestic of glittery horns. I can make lots of whatness statements about something that has no isness. But I can't just predicate of it and it exists as if this was another quality, like the fact that it's pink or leaping magically. No, that's not the type of thing which is a predicate. We can't say and it has existness. Not really. That is an isness, not a whatness. And the isness is the grounds for anything having any possession of an actual whatness in reality. Therefore, the concept of conceiving of great-making attributes and their possibility does literally nothing to show their actuality, even if you at least pretend to conceive of it actually existing. That doesn't help. Misunderstanding the nature of isness and whatness. Next up, we have Aquinas. Now, Avicenna over there raising his impeccable eyebrow, extracting all the divine attributes, getting all the ladies. Kant over there in the corner. We have Aquinas right up front, whose ridiculous haircut and vow of celibacy preclude him from getting all the ladies, but nevertheless is arguing passionately that the problem with the ontological argument is that we can't imagine God's essence. That's just simply impossible. So without divine assistance, or without divine revelation, which is certainly rejected by people who don't accept anything divine, then how are we going to know this nature, which supposedly implies itself if we were to understand it, right? So he's saying, just under the light of just without God's help or anything, we're just kind of at apophaticism, something similar, where we can say what God is not, but we can't imagine positively his essence and then infer his actuality from this. So Aquinas slaps down the ontological argument and gives us much better things. So an alternative would be, say, the De Ante argument, etc. But what do other people say? Well, another common objection is that inserted into all these arguments is basically a way of defining into existence. We're just basically saying, stamping our foot and arguing that God does exist, and we're sneaking that into the definitions. I think that that does happen with a variety of the arguments. Another famous counterexample is the greatest possible island. And you may have heard of that one, and you probably shouldn't, because I don't think it's a very good objection. I think that objection fails in objecting to the ontological argument because it misses the point of what Ansem and others actually are talking about when they talk about greatness. So although I agree with Kant's critique, I agree with Aquinas' critique, I agree with what I imagine would be Avicenna's critique, I don't agree with this one. I think it actually survives the so-called greatest possible island objection. I don't think that it would also prove that island if it proved God. Now, I haven't gotten into all of the formulations of this argument because there are many. If you want something that does do that, Google Peter Vanenwagen, which is a tremendous last name, by the way, and you'll find that he put out a great article comparing, I think, four different versions of the ontological arguments. Let me know what you think, if you have a favorite, and if you think any of them work. So here are a couple patches that have been made. One by our friend Pat Flynn. Here's what he suggests, and I think it's interesting. Good old Pat suggested that if we focus on what blocks a being from existence, and then show that there could be a being that is not blocked, then the being would exist. But here we seek to, here we're trying to jump from the premise that God could exist to the premise that he does exist, but it's unclear why any being could be real as a default and is only blocked from being instead of the other way around, right? Like Avicenna argued earlier that these possible beings, ones that could be, well, they're not blocked from being and would be real if they weren't blocked, but actually need to be actively caused. So the default is that they're not real and need to be caused. So I think there might be something that we could use to patch up some stuff here. I think he's on to the right track. Well, I don't think Pat actually thinks this makes the ontological work either. Now, I think he could pull in some de ante reasoning or some contingency necessity reasoning. He's a very smart fellow, and make it work. However, I don't think it would be the ontological argument anymore. And this is about why the ontological argument seems to fail. Now, I have suggested at some point on this podcast, and I'll run through it again, a version of the ontological argument that is my very best try to make this work. So first, a little bit of stage setting. Imagine that existence is like sugar cookie dough. And form, or essence, is like a shape cut into it. So it limits the existence of the sugar cookie dough. And it limits it in the shape of a snowman or something. Now we see that we couldn't have, let's say, a square circle. Why? Because the circleness shape cuts off the right angles of the squareness. Or the squareness cuts off the arc of the circle, right? These two things can't be cut out of the same sugar cookie because they're just contrary types of forms. So either could exist, but they just can't exist together. Other things, let's say the snowman's hat or the buttons or his mittens, well, these are compatible forms that could exist in one being, say our sugar cookie snowman. Now, I'm going to say that here's how we can describe the greatest possible being. It's not just we predicate every wonderful thing, including existence. No. Instead, we say that the greatest possible being is the one who has his existence limited to the least degree. In other words, his shape is not limited by a sugar cookie punch at all. His shape is simply the shape of all of the sugar cookie dough. And that is a non-arbitrary stopping point to which nothing more could even in principle be added. So we dodge some of the objections that, wait a minute, can't we always add a great-making property? No, we can't, because the definition is that it's unlimited by a form, and then it just is all of the sugar cookie dough. That is a principled chop. Stop. Because it's just all. So God is the greatest possible being in that he's the least limited, having no form, but just being existence himself. So his essence, his whatness, his shapeness is his existence. Now, if I say that no duck-billed platypuses exist, then what I'm doing is I'm extracting the form of platypus from it, a platypus or the concept of it or whatever, and into my mind, and then I'm negating it. I'm saying, platypuses. I have a platypus in my mind. No platypuses. You're not real. Now, maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. It's possible that none of them exist. It's possible some do exist, right? Now, if I say square circles exist, then it is certain that I'm wrong. It's impossible because there is no form of a square circle to affirm. My mind cannot abstract and hold in its mind in any way a square circle, which I can say, yeah, square circle in my mind. Got it. Yes, you exist. I can't actually make the statement to affirm a square circle because although I can say the words, there is no abstracted form for me to say, yes, you exist to. Ergo, it is impossible. Now, what about with God? Well, interestingly, I cannot extract his intelligible form either, but not because his form is cutting existence off of himself, like the squareness cuts off the roundness or the roundness cuts off the squareness. It doesn't have that problem. It's existence and existence to the maximum. So instead, I can't actually extract his intelligible form because he doesn't have one. Well, not one any different from the fact that he is just endless proverbial sugar cookie extending forever. So because he just is existence with a capital E and a few exclamation marks, that can never, that infinite, immeasurable existence cannot dwell as a concept in my mind, even in principle. Not because it's impossible, as if it cut itself off from itself, but because even in principle it cannot be abstracted, because there's nothing to abstract. Thus, we can say it is not impossible for God to exist, right? Meaning his form does not cut itself off from itself. And it is impossible to negate the thesis that God does exist, since we can't hold the form of God in our mind to say, you don't exist, kind of like we did with the duck-billed platypus. So anything that can be imagined is possible, if not impossible. Seems like an obvious one. So anything that can be imagined is possible if it's not impossible, right? So if it doesn't cut itself off with some type of thing which negates it, well, it's something that could be possible. God is not impossible. Thus, he is at least possible, right? So he doesn't cut himself off from being. Therefore, he is not impossible. Thus, he is possible. Pretty, so far, so good. Next step. Anything that is possible and whose existence cannot be negated is necessary. So God has no form, thus his existence cannot in principle be negated. Therefore, since God is possible and non-existible, God exists. Does this work? First off, I want to say, I got to read more Avicenna, because I found out literally today that the time argument that I had been working on is literally something Avicenna did, and the whole idea of moving from impossibility, possibility, existence, negation, being, etc. is a heck of a lot like his argument. So, I get this guy. He's like my spirit animal. I'm a fan. Got to read more of him. I'll get back to you maybe with an episode on that. Now, does this formulation of what I'm going to call the ontological argument work? I mean, I don't know. I don't think maybe. Here's what I can tell you. We definitely dodged the island, the perfect island objection, because we gave a principled reason for the maximum greatness. I think Kant would be cool with this, so we get a green light from Kant because we aren't treating existence like a predicate. Our man Aquinas would likewise give us a thumbs up because we actually operate on the premise that we cannot even in principle abstract what God's essence is and hold it in our mind. So I think we get a green light from Kant. We get a green light from Aquinas. I also kind of laid out Avicenna, what he might critique the ontological argument with, and I think we're dodging that because apparently we're leaning on a bunch of his possibility, necessity, etc. Premises, which he'd be very friendly to. So, like, four or five of the biggest critiques I think we've dodged, and I don't see any place where I just defined God into existence. So does this work? Maybe. I do have my doubts about saying that if a being's existence cannot be negated, we can say that he must exist. Because what if, and I got to think about that, what if that's just more of a comment on our mode of thinking and less of a comment on like the metaphysics of if a being's being that only has its essence as its existence can have what we can call its essence negated, if we don't first have to abstract it into a mind. So if it's possible to negate such things without abstracting into a mind, well, then all we can say from my argument is that we can't negate this, not that it can't be negated in principle, at which point we haven't moved God from the possibility to the necessity category yet. So that's my big problem with my formulation here. I think that's what would need to be defended. Next, I think the idea that not having a limiting form is even possible would need some defense, though I see nothing wrong with such a state of affairs. I think that there's nothing illogical or impossible about that, so we'd at least be able to defend the possibility of such a thing. Maybe somebody could claim that this argument proves pantheism, since it seems to be treating all existing things as existing at a single metaphysical level, and thus God includes us in the rest of things, and the rest of anything which had any form cutting out anything, and all the scraps of the cookie dough in the middle. I could see somebody making that argument, so it'd need defense there, so I'm not sure it's proving the God of classical theism, and I'm sure I could go on and blather some more. Suffice to say, I don't think that the ontological argument is a great one. I don't think most formulations work. I have tried my hardest to make it work, and I don't think that my version works, or at least I don't think it's persuasive enough and ironclad enough to present as if it was a proof of God. So what to use instead? Well, I think Aquinas' De Ente is fantastic. You could go back to good old Avicenna's argument. You could go to the first way, the third way, or really just anything else, anything but the ontological argument. All right, that leads us to the final section. We got through the big ones. So I'm going to do some rapid-fire arguments that I don't like. These are arguments which are proposed for theism. The most rapid-fire one: the Bible says so. Well, that's clearly not going to be a good argument because, well, it's circular. So, because the Bible tells me so, therefore there is a God, we get to kick that one out. Another one, which is better, is, hey, this guy named Jesus rose from the dead. He claimed to be God. How are you going to rise from the dead if you're not God? Ergo, God exists. I mean, fact check true. Jesus did rise from the dead, but I don't think this is a good argument for God. Now, it could be a spark that gets people looking into arguments for theism. It certainly was for me. It certainly is the most important question of history. Everybody must admit that something very strange happened, and no event I can think of really changed the world more than whatever the heck happened. Nothing. So this is a question. What happened with Jesus? Did he rise from the dead? But I don't think it can get us to theism. Could be a few points theism. That would be more likely under theism than naturalism, sure. But I think we need to go back a few steps in order for us to say, yeah, it totally rose from the dead, must have been a Messiah. I mean, what is a Messiah? Well, now we have to argue for, say, the Old Testament, because you don't know what a Messiah is. I think now we have to say, well, he was God. Like, where did that come from? Well, now we have to argue for an incarnation. Well, how are we going to get to an incarnation? Well, we certainly need to secure the premise that God exists to be incarnate. So I don't think that this is a good argument for God. It presumes too many things which first need defending. We should begin with God, and in light of God, we can get things like morality, right? I don't think it's as easy to go from morality to God, but it's pretty easy to go from God to morality. So if we have God, we get morality, we get the fact that people are religious, and we get like, then God must have intended for us to be religious, etc. And then given religion, given morality, given the fact of sin, given the problems that we have in humanity, given the history that we see, including history in the Old Testament, the seeming reliability there, how that jives with classical theism, etc. And then that goes in turn to predict a Messiah. We could expect an incarnation event. And then, blam, we have a resurrection, which is highly attested to. Well, then, under that paradigm, sure, Jesus rose from the dead. Makes total sense. But if we don't have the rest in place, I would say the most people could say is something really weird happened, and maybe I just don't know what. Or maybe it did rise from the dead, and the world universe is crazy. Who knows? But here, just start with God instead. And then build up to that. It's important to get Christianity, but not the place to go for theism. Here's another argument you'd commonly hear, is the argument from personal experience of God. And great, this can absolutely be great evidence for you, but it's not an argument that you can use to help other people. A personal revelation is like a motorcycle. It's really just designed for one person. And it's far more dangerous and is far less reliable than, say, a train. Yes, it can be a faster and more exciting way to get you to your destination, in this case, theism, but sometimes it can go horribly wrong and you could be part of, like, a death cult. So the classic arguments for God are like a train. They can be a little bit slower, a little bit more boring, but they're safer, they're more reliable, and they will arrive you at a sure destination, the platform of classical theism. So experiences for God can help you, not necessarily other people, and they're not as reliable, and I think that we should ground it in things which reflect our nature as rational beings. Don't get me wrong, can be great, can be good reasons, but aren't always. So here's what I propose instead of this: faith. Aquinas argues in depth about how faith is more sure than anything because it's saying yes to God who is truth. So God can give you faith and immediate sight of the fact of his existence. And if you have that, well, you really can't beat that. Logic goes through a series of steps to see that God exists. Faith sees that God exists. And it's not given, you know, by our own work, it's given by God directly. So it's the most trustable thing. It's not just an experience, it's a gift. It's a supernatural unveiling of God who is truth. So that is better than simply a experience like a great coincidence or even a miracle. The next one I want to deal with is just look at the beauty of the world and just tell me there is no God. So the argument from beauty. I know I didn't really steel man that one, but you guys have heard such things. I think this is convincing to people who are already in the theistic worldview and largely unhelpful for others. I could imagine somebody rigorously defending some form of an argument from beauty, especially if they could somehow prove that it's a transcendental, which I don't think it is. But I think that the common objections from the possibility that beauty is something that is evolved are fairly persuasive. In fact, I think they're good enough, plausible counterarguments to pretty much make us want to ditch this one. Let me just give you a few examples. We love, say, mountains. We feel an instant feeling of like peace, relaxation, looking off for a huge, long, beautiful, scenic vista where we see for miles and miles. That feels great, right? Well, kind of back to evolution, creating bounded and unbounded desires and things. There are systems which are regulated with like an upper and lower boundary. And there's ones where it's like, he's never going to need an upper boundary. Just give us a lower boundary. And I think this is an explanation for, say, why we love beautiful far views. Because our body wants to make sure that we are not trapped or claustrophobic feeling, because that's a sign that we are very vulnerable or that we could get caught somewhere. So if you take a little rat and you stuff him in a little tube and he can't wiggle his little rat arms and legs, he's going to be upset. He's going to be stressed out. And so would you. Now, if you put him in a place where he doesn't really know what his surroundings are, he can't see very far, there could be a predator, he doesn't see any food near, he doesn't see any friends near, that's also really, really stressful. I mean, I know this feeling. I'm not claustrophobic, but one time I was working on a porch and it was about 16 inches off the ground. So I had to slither in and I tied a rope around my feet. And my very large cousin Sam was on the other end of the rope so that after I got all the way to the end of the porch, which was very, very far and very dark and had who knows what living in there, he could drag me out because I couldn't wiggle back out very effectively. How did I feel there? Not good. I didn't like it. So I think that you would certainly evolve stress when you have the feeling of confinement. So when you get to the mountain, that whole system that normally regulates your desire to flee from claustrophobic situations 100% shuts down. So the amount of stress you feel plummets, which gives you a feeling of peace. So there's a balance of peaceful hormones or whatever neuroregulators flowing through your little noggin. So we feel at peace. So why do we love things that are beautiful like lakes and oceans and rivers? Well, certainly biological programming would certainly send us to places with lots of abundant food and water. That makes sense. You could ask, well, okay, but beauty doesn't make sense being evolved. Why do we like flowers? Well, here's why. Because flowers make fruits. All fruits come from flowers. And interestingly, women, who historically have been more likely to be the ones gathering such things instead of necessarily spearing the woolly mammoth in the face, are the ones who like flowers more. Because it's a signal that there's a bunch of fruits that could be in the area, that there's good soil, that there's is a great verdant gathering ground. So it makes you happy, feel good, feel at peace, feel like you have things. So there you go. Here's another one. People are beautiful, and it's not just sexual attraction. Well, here's the thing. That could be another one of those regulations whereby we try to avoid people who have disease. So there's very strong evidence for what's called disease repulsion. When it looks like you could be sick, people want to stay away from you. So that's something that maybe there's no upper bound. There's no reason to be like, hey, don't be around people too beautiful now. No. So it's just your body saying, watch out if people look deranged, because that might be like a parasite or something. So stay away. So you feel good and at ease and happy when you're around people who are beautiful. Maybe that could be an explanation for beauty. And I can already hear it. Fine, 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 people, flowers, lakes, rivers, mountains, things like that. But we appreciate works of art, even abstract works of art. Tell me how on earth we could spin an evolutionary yarn to somehow explain how we could love that. Well, here we go. I'm gonna do the Just So story here. When you look at art from really any period across many cultures, you're going to find what's called the golden ratio. It's a group of, it's like a proportion between different things that we find incredibly beautiful. Okay, why would that be evolved? Well, let me tell you, because you can derive the golden ratio from the natural log, the number E. Okay, why would that matter? I don't understand. Ah, let me tell you, because when things are growing with everything they need and they are unencumbered, things grow according to the natural log, E. In other words, if you see trees and people and animals and all sorts of other stuff, heck, I think that even like minerals can grow at E, though I gotta check on that. Anyways, if you see all this, it shows that you're in an area with all the resources needed for everything to be thriving and growing and expanding unencumbered. Well, that's wonderful. That tells you you're in a great place. This is wonderful. This is beautiful. Evolution would program you to really like and feel positive when you see the result of the natural, unencumbered, natural log, which expresses itself in the golden ratio, which we then build in subconsciously to all sorts of works of art. And then we make them colorful. And of course, colorful areas, verdant, full of plants, varieties of plants, diverse nutrient sources, all this also would be selected for. So you put all these things together, we could totally enjoy abstract works of art with beautiful people, lakes and oceans and mountains and rivers and beautiful colors and natural logs everywhere we see. Now, yes, I'm spinning a bit of a just-so story, and I think it's reasonable, and I think it's reasonable enough to neutralize the assertion that beauty could not have come from evolution, ergo, our sense of beauty must have come from God. So what do we use instead? If, look, there's beauty, ergo, this couldn't come from a natural process, it must have been from God. If that doesn't really work, or is not terribly persuasive, what should we use instead? Well, I think we can use the fourth way. We can talk about how things are better, have more goodness, how things are more true, how things are more noble, and we can lay out how this eventually leads us to God via the fourth way. We can also say, look at all the amazing, wonderful, beautiful, incredible things. Let's run a fine-tuning argument. And I'm not laying out all of these alternative arguments. I've already laid out one. But a fine-tuning argument can be defended against things like multiverses and the effect that basically the only people who would be able to comment on the universe are the people who end up existing, and the only people who end up existing are the ones who are in universes which ended up being tuned well enough for them to exist. So if we're dealing with the people who actually exist, we wouldn't expect that we'd find, you know, like naturalistic universes where people go, well, this thing has nothing but iron because there'd be no people to make that comment. Blah, 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 blah. I think those can be answered. Lots of people making good fine-tuning arguments. I don't think that they're absolutely conclusive, but I do think they point towards theism. And it is a way to take our understanding of the beauty of the universe and make it a little bit more rigorous than just, come on, there must be God. So fine-tuning, fourth way, that's what I'd go with instead. Which leads me to our last one, intelligent design. Now, not all versions of this are bad. I think that the best intelligent design guys very quickly drift into the fifth way of Thomas Aquinas or a type of fine-tuning direction. And both of these, I think, can be perfectly reasonable. I could see how those could work. What I'm criticizing is more of the garden variety Protestant versions. Think Creation Museum. Think Ken Ham. A banana disproves atheism because, as you can see, the banana curves towards your face. Which my brother famously says, but my banana's curving away from my face. And you think I'm making fun of him, but that's actually something Ken Ham said. So, here's the form this argument often takes. Either things came through atheistic evolution or a theistic act of creation. Evolution is impossible. Therefore, creationism, thus theism, is true. Well, here's the problem. Premise one is just wrong. This does not present all categories. It's not just atheistic evolution or theistic creation, because theistic evolution is an option and squares with everything observable. Further, as we see the fact of a good God and the fact of a created order where intelligent, complex, conscious, and moral beings result from a natural process, we can see this is super compatible. The idea of a good God and the emergence of moral conscious creatures from a good universe? Yeah, what's wrong with that? So the reason to reject atheistic evolution, I think, is the atheism and the near unanimous rejection of formal and final causality, and the very poor prediction power of their paradigm. And the reasons to reject theistic creationism is the utter lack of scientific rigor across a massive amounts of disciplines. The reasons to reject theistic evolution are either non-existent or utterly uncompelling, and the reasons to embrace it are the sum of all the reasons to embrace any decent part of the aforementioned other theories. But that's not my only problem with this. Also, premise two is wrong. Premise two is evolution is impossible. And if we get rid of the concept of form and finality from our metaphysics, then, and God is not in the picture at all, well, sure, I agree, evolution is impossible. really anything is impossible at that point. But if we include form and finality, if we include God in the picture, then evolution is perfectly possible, and then the argument fails. And then the next part is, kind of like the Kalam, kind of like some other arguments, this argument does not conclude at the God of classical theism. So why would the God of creationism need to be all-powerful, not just really powerful? Why would he need to be all-knowing, not just really knowing? It seems like just a really powerful, really smart, pseudo-God could totally do the trick. Or let's press it further. Why not assume that everything was created by a race of intelligent aliens? Now, where did they come from? Ah, you see, they evolved. And unfortunately for the creationists, whereas here on Earth, let's grant all their arguments. The funding for creationism is not good enough. And if we looked into the science, we'd understand that the disciplines that we have in geology and paleontology and genetics and whatnot are flawed. And here on Earth, it did not happen. Well, that doesn't prove that it couldn't happen in other places. So it turns out on the alien planet, it did happen. Possible. Your evidence from this planet doesn't disprove evolution on their planet. So they evolved and then they invented you. What's the problem with that? Now, maybe you could make some statistical, analytical arguments why chance cannot have this happen. And I'm open to those. Those are a little bit more reasonable. But finding what the chance and probability of different events like the beginning of life, I think is a tall order. I just don't think that can be known. Therefore, you can have all the math you like. My issue is, what variables are you putting in? What coefficients are you adding? How on earth are you filling out that formula if a formula can be made? So even if the creationists are right that all the evidence on earth points towards a creator, I don't think that gets us God. I think that could get us an alien or an angel or a demon or a not very powerful God. So what do we do instead? Well, fine-tuning argument, fifth way, or maybe we just make like a probabilistic argument from, say, hey, we got conscious beings in the end, more likely under theism than atheism, so maybe something intended these. It's reasonable. All right. That's my whole list, guys. Yeah, to sum up this whole episode, we're not supposed to be just theistic hacks, fanboys or fangirls, as the case may be. I don't think we should be greenlighting every argument that seems to cut in our favor. Because God is truth, and we do not honor God by overlooking errors or swallowing falsehoods. Theism is not fragile and doesn't need to be handled with kid gloves. So go ahead, swing the baseball bat of skeptical objections at your favorite arguments for God. Most and probably all of Aquinas's stand up to the test, and so do plenty of others. I think we need to show skeptics and atheists that we are 100% honest in our pursuit of the truth. And when we do so, I think this is very compelling. I wish that when I was an atheist, I encountered more people who would be open and fully relaxed about saying some hard stuff, not just about C.S. Lewis, but about some of the classic, most popular arguments for God. That would give me a lot of faith that, you know what, these guys are being honest. They're perfectly willing to say, Kalam doesn't quite do it. Moral argument, not really. Ontological argument, don't think it works. I would trust somebody who says, here are the ones that don't work, here's why. A lot more than somebody who just seems to be just a fanboy. So, I think that's all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope that some of the ones which I suggested instead, you guys can look into. It is interesting. I just went in and asked AI, what are the most popular arguments for God on the internet? After I assembled this list of arguments I didn't like, it was almost identical. So the most popular arguments on the internet are the ones which I like the least. So go out there, guys, and make good arguments popular again. And I'll talk to you next time.